Welcome, everybody. This is the fifth lecture for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, Government Intervention. It's May 22nd, 2014. And we are today going through government inflation and debt. We're nearing the end of our journey through the textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist. And let me just explain the strategy here. In terms of where we're going. In the book, I wanted to focus on, when I was writing the textbook, I was thinking, this may be the only book on economics that somebody ever reads. That was what I, and so what needs to be in here? And so that's, for example, why drug prohibition was in there, which we covered last time, because I thought somebody, you know, that's one of the most important things that the study of economics can give somebody, at least in today's environment, is an understanding of why the drug war fails to achieve the goal that its supporters think it's going to give them. And I thought what I really wanted to lead up to was Austrian business cycle theory. So that's what we're going to cover next week in the final lecture. But in order to really get that, you first need to understand government inflation. And so that's why we're covering that in this lecture and why it was earlier in the textbook. So it's these things are all building on each other. Obviously, government inflation is important in its own right, but I'm just saying this now because I'm going to repeat it again next time too. I just really want you to get this. The Austrian school is fairly unique in that it recognizes that government monetary inflation is problematic or destructive, not merely because it debases the currency. So that's what we're going to talk about today, among other things, is the direct, obvious problem with the government being able just to print money at will, that reduces the purchasing power of money and makes savers poorer to the extent that they have assets denominated in the government's currency. Right? Everybody knows that. But what the Austrians know beyond that simple fact is that in practice, when the government inflates, that new money tends to enter the economy through the credit markets, and so it temporarily pushes down interest rates. And that sets off an unsustainable boom and gives rise to what we all know of as the boom-bust cycle that a lot of people think is just a normal part of a market economy. Okay, so I'm getting ahead of ourselves. That's what we're going to talk about next week in the last lecture. It's the last chapter in the textbook. But I just want to flag for you guys and make sure you see that the things we're covering today when we talk about inflation are fairly standard, that all free market economists would endorse. But then we're laying the groundwork for next week. We're going to focus on a particularly insidious effect of government monetary inflation that was developed by the Austrians. Okay, so you can see we are covering a lot of material today. Okay, we're talking about government inflation, first of all, then later in today's lecture, we're gonna hit government debt. So the old switcheroo, what do I mean by that? Hang on, I gotta turn this pen on. What I mean here is that the very term inflation has undergone a shift in its meaning. And I think in the textbook I give you a quote from Henry Hazlitt to document this fact. All right, and it's you see it a lot in the writings of Mises and Rothbard and other famous Austrian economists. And people like Peter Schiff complain about this nowadays. And this is just another area where the Austrians are making their point to the general public, and then this supposedly sophisticated Keynesian mainstream economists roll their eyes and all those fuddy-duddy Austrian arguing over words. All right, so let me just walk you through this issue, and you'll see why Austrians stress this. Okay, so there's two types of inflation. You could be have in mind monetary inflation or price inflation. Okay, so monetary inflation, what that means is an increase in the quantity of money. Some people have a broader definition where they'll say an increase in the quantity of money and credit. Incidentally, let me just point something out. Okay, so I'm saying watch out, talking about the supply of money can be misleading. So I am quite consciously in this lecture trying to make sure I just say an increase in the quantity of money. And the reason for that is because normally, and an economist, professional economists do this as well, and it's my natural inclination, but like I said, I'm consciously trying to suppress the urge. You normally want to say, you'll hear people say, oh yeah, monetary inflation means an increase in the supply of money. Or when the supply of money goes up, other things equal, prices rise and things like that. And those are all defensible statements, but what I'm warning you about is if what you have in mind is how many dollar bills are floating around or how many dollar bills as paper currency plus commercial checking accounts and so on, if you're thinking of it in terms of, oh, the amount of money went from such and such trillion dollars to such and such trillion dollars over the course of the year, that's not really supply, because remember, supply is the whole schedule. Okay, so if there's a bigger apple harvest this year, it can be a little bit confusing if you just say, oh, the supply of apples went up. If that's all you mean is more apples were harvested, right? So again, forget money for a second. But strictly speaking, here's the supply and here's the demand. If we're talking about apples, let's say, and you can imagine that even if the supply goes down, if the demand goes way up, so that's demand and this is supply, then the quantity of apples actually harvested could go up. Okay, so let me just say that again. In other words, that, again, forget money. Just think about apples. Just think about normal supply and demand curves. This stuff, if you guys took the course last time, the middle course, this should be child's play for you. But it is entirely possible. There's nothing weird about me saying, oh yeah, the supply of apples went down, but the total quantity of apples sold on the market went up. That's not a contradiction. Okay. Well, what would have to be true is that the demand for apples went up, right? Because if the supply goes down, the only way to keep the equilibrium quantity from also falling is if the demand goes up, right? The demand stays the same and supply goes down, well then you know the equilibrium quantity goes down also. So again, just think about apples for a minute. If what you're trying to say, if what you've observed is that there are more total apples that get picked and sold in the grocery store and eaten this year compared to last year, or this harvest compared to last harvest, strictly speaking, you don't know whether it's true to say the supply of apples went up. That could be true, but it doesn't need to be true. And in fact, the supply of apples could have even gone down, if by supply we mean the correct economic terminology of the whole supply curve shifted left. That's theoretically possible, again, because the demand could have risen enough to offset that, such that in the new equilibrium, the total quantity supplied is higher than it was before, even though supply itself shifted left. Okay, so I'm just stressing this pedantic point, because a lot of times when we're talking about monetary inflation, and again, everybody does this, even professional economists, even me, we will loosely say, oh yeah, the money supply went up, and that's why you see prices go up. And a lot of times what we actually mean is the total quantity of money in the new equilibrium is higher now than it was a year ago. And again, strictly speaking, we don't know what the supply is. And in fact, what gets really tricky is when you talk about the supply curve of money, if there's a central bank, things get really complicated. All right, the supply of apples makes sense. It's saying at various hypothetical prices, what quantity of apples will producers try to sell? That's what the supply of apples means. But when you say, what's the supply of money? Technically, you mean at various possible prices of money, or purchasing powers of money, how much money do the owners of money want to sell? And that gets a little bit tricky to even define what you mean if you're also including the ability of a central bank to create new money. Okay, so I'm not trying to mess you guys up and confuse you. I'm just taking a few minutes here to explain why you're going to hear me saying or referring to changes in the quantity of money when you might be wondering, well, why isn't he saying the supply of money? I normally hear people talking about the supply of money, so this is why. Okay, but back to the original point, historically, like back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, if economic writers were talking about inflation, they probably meant monetary inflation. But then there's another possibility or another usage, and this is what has now become the popular default meaning, and that's price inflation, meaning you specify a certain average of prices, like consumer price index or producer price index or GDP deflator, whatever. You have some basket of goods perhaps weighted in a certain way so that the price of one type of good might be more important than another. And then you compute changes in that index over time, and that's the way you measure how much are prices rising. And that's what a lot of people nowadays mean when they say inflation. It's certainly what the media means. It's probably what the general public means. And it's, somebody will say something like, oh, yeah, I'm making a lot more at my job, but once you factor in inflation, it's actually not so much. And that sort of thing. What they mean is prices have gotten higher as well, and so the fact that my paycheck is a bigger amount measured in money overstates how much better off I am because things keep getting more expensive. All right, so you can't point to exactly when did this semantic switch change, but the Austrians have been talking about, because Mises kind of saw it with his own eyes. It happened during his lifetime. He mentioned it, that it did change. That back in the day, if you just said inflation, what you meant was an increase in the quantity of money, whereas nowadays, so it had happened during the 20th century, this semantic revolution, people mean price inflation. Okay, so who cares? And this is, like I say, I've personally gotten hit on this several times. I've seen in the blogosphere people rolling their eyes at these pedantic, fuddy-duddy Austrian economists who, geez, they don't like the fact that the word liberal used to mean one thing and now it means something else, and now they're whining and complaining about inflation too. Why don't these guys, get something real to occupy themselves with instead of complaining over words? Well, it does matter, just like it matters that the very word liberal has had its meaning totally transformed. The same thing here, that Mises in particular, and Rothbard picked this up, stresses that everybody historically understood the connection between the two. So it's not crazy that when you're talking about monetary inflation, you naturally, the discussion spills over into price inflation because there's a direct causal link. Other things equal, increasing the quantity of money will increase prices. And so when you're trying to figure out the effects of monetary inflation, one of the obvious implications is if there's too much monetary inflation, then prices will rise very quickly. And everybody understands the problem with prices rising unexpectedly fast. And so that's the connection. But Mises' point is, it's very dangerous and serves the interest of the government that now the term inflation doesn't refer to the cause, but instead refers to the symptom. And Mises says, this isn't an exact quote, but something like, you can't fight a policy that you can't name. And so he's saying, at this point now, we have lost the ability to even identify the thing that we're fighting against. If you as an economist committed to what's called sound money, don't want the government to debase the currency, if you don't want the government to engage in unchecked monetary inflation, well, now it's harder to even get your position across to the general public, because if you start talking about, I'm against inflation or inflation is bad, well, the public thinks you mean I'm against prices rising. And so then they might support government measures to suppress price inflation, which is exactly what in the United States happened in the 1970s. Right? In 1971, Richard Nixon finally abolished the last vestiges of the original gold standard. And so now there was nothing backing up the U.S. dollar. There was no formal check or constraint against the Federal Reserve's ability to create new dollars. Whereas up until 1971, technically, people, foreign banks, central banks, could turn in their dollars for gold. And so the Fed couldn't just inflate willy-nilly, because it knew if it inflated too much, people would turn in these excess dollars and the Fed would run out of gold. Okay? But after 1971, that check was gone, and it's not a coincidence that it was precisely in the 1970s that the U.S. had a really bad bout of inflation, monetary and price inflation, even though there was no major war. And during the 1970s, what did the U.S. government do? It had all of these ridiculous schemes of wage and price controls, because the public was very upset about rising prices, which, you know, was unusually high for peacetime in the 1970s. And they wanted the government to do something. And so the politicians swaggered in and said, oh, okay, well, you know what it is? It's these greedy labor unions, or it's those Arabs who are sticking it to us with their oil embargo, or it's greedy businesses that are backing up prices to try to squeeze more money from consumers. Right? So it's always somebody else's fault. It's not the fault of the government, which is creating more dollars. And so Mises' point is that by switching what inflation was talking about, it gets harder to fight it. That now you're just attacking the symptoms, which leads to all sorts of disastrous consequences, which you guys now know because you've studied this class, or you've taken this class. Okay. So, the price of money. Let's talk a little bit about this. So, what do we mean by the price of money? Definition. The price of money is its purchasing power. So, how many goods and services would someone need to offer in order to buy a unit of money? If you really want to understand the way to incorporate money and price inflation into the rest of economics as you've learned it up till now, you got to make this mental switch. It's a little bit awkward at first, but just think of it as treat money as just any other commodity for the moment. And so think of apples. What's the price of apples? Well, that's saying, if you want to buy apples, how much of something do you have to give up in order to get the apples? And so the price of money, if you want to acquire money from somebody, if you want to buy money, what does that mean? Well, you got to give up something in order to get the money. So again, it's tricky, because normally we think of, oh, when you buy something, you're the one with the money and you're acquiring real goods and services. And when you sell something, you're the one giving up real goods and services in order to acquire money, but I want you to flip that. Think of it as you are a seller of real goods and services trying to buy money, and somebody else is selling money and is buying real goods and services. So, you know, your employer. If your employer is willing to, it starts out with money and then wants to hire you, what's going on? The employer, one way to think about it, the employer is selling you units of money in order to buy your labor. And you are selling your labor in order to buy money. And so the laws of supply and demand all go through, it all works. It's just the one little trick is that the way you normally think about prices is going to get inverted. All right, so we just have supply and demand. So now this is going to be a supply and demand of money. All right, so there's the demand. And so this is, you know, the price of money. Here, let me switch to the text. So the only trick here is when money gets more expensive, when the price of money gets higher, it actually means that the prices of everything else quoted in money goes down. Right? So it's like the inverse of what you're used to thinking of. So don't worry about this graph for a second. I'll come back to it in a minute, but just think this through. If everything in the economy, I'm going to just talk in terms of dollars. Obviously, think of it in your own currency if you're foreign. If you're foreign compared to me. If I'm a foreigner compared to you. Right, so everything has a certain amount. So something costs $10 right now. And then next year it costs $20. In general, if everything else doubled in price. Right, there's two ways of thinking about that. One way is to think everything got twice as expensive in terms of money. Or another way of thinking of it is that money is now worth half as much. The price of money just got cut in half. Okay, so this thing, I don't know, a movie ticket to a movie theater. It's right now it's $10, let's say, for an evening performance, evening show. Okay? And then later on it's $20. One way of saying it is that the price of the ticket doubled, but another way of saying it is that the price of the money just went down. That before, in order to get $1, you had to sell 1/10 of a movie ticket. But now, after time has passed, in order to acquire $1, in order to buy $1, you, the owner of the movie theater, only have to sell 1/20th of a ticket. Okay, so the amount of real goods and services you have to give up in order to acquire money has gone down when prices in general go up. Right? Or think of it in terms of your labor. If you're originally making $10 an hour and now you make $20 an hour, it has become cheaper for you to buy money by selling off your labor services. Before you had to work for 1/10 of an hour, right, 6 minutes, and now you only got to work for 1/20 of an hour, 3 minutes. Okay, so before, in order for you to earn a dollar, in order for you to buy a dollar bill from a seller, a guy who has dollar bills and is willing to sell them, you had to buy with 6 minutes of labor, but now you only got to pay 3 minutes of labor to acquire that single dollar bill. Okay, so that's that. Now, why would the demand curve for money, looking back at this diagram again, why would the demand curve look like that? Well, it's saying as the price of money goes down, the quantity demanded of money goes up. So people want to acquire more money the cheaper it is. And what that, you know, if you think about why would somebody want to acquire money? Well, it's what it's saying is things in general are more expensive, people want to hold larger cash balances. Right? So make sure you just, before you try to figure out why is that true or why does that sound plausible, let's make sure you understand what I just said. And then you can speculate as to the why, but let's first nail down the what. So again, I'm just saying that proposition in different terms. So over here, what would it mean? This demand curve that I've drawn for money is downward sloping. So what does that even mean when we're talking about money? Well, again, this axis is measuring the price of money. So we're saying as the price of money goes down, demanders want to get more of it. So people want to hold more money, the demand to hold money, or the desire to acquire money, people selling things to get money. Okay, so again, the price of money as it goes down, people want to buy more of it, right? So again, other things equal, if things are more expensive, you want to hold larger cash balances. Think of it as, why would people want to hold money in the first place? It's because it helps you go buy things. So you want to hold money to account for unplanned transactions, let's say. You want to have enough money on you to be able to facilitate certain purchases, like unplanned things. You know what I'm saying? So the amount of money you just want to have on your person, think of it like this. How much money do you want to carry around in your wallet or your purse in general? Now, of course, things change. Like you'll go and hit the ATM maybe at the beginning of the week, and then it goes down over time, then you replenish it. But the point is, what's your average desired cash balance? And the point is, if things are more expensive, you actually would want to hold more money, other things equal. All right. So, for example, I have this funny thing. I stumbled upon my checkbook from when I was much younger. Like I don't know why I had, but I stumbled upon, you know, the check register where you write down your transactions. And one of the entries from many years ago is I took out $5 from the ATM and I put in a little memo to myself. A date that I was going out with this girl. Okay, so don't get me wrong, I was still a cheapskate even then, but the point is I hit the ATM and took out $5 because I was about to go on the date and wanted to bolster my cash holdings. All right, whereas now I don't even know if you're allowed to take $5 out of the ATM. That's such a little amount. You know, I can't remember. You just take it out in multiples of 20. Okay, so And so why is that? Well, part of the reason is, besides that I was a super cheapskate back then, but part of the reason is things are more expensive now. So having $5 in your wallet doesn't do anything now compared to back then. Okay, so that's one thing. That's one way to understand what's going on. Bangle asks, and it's a good question, so let me hit it right now. So wouldn't you want to buy as many things as possible before the price of money falls further? That's a great question, but you're misunderstanding what this demand curve is showing. It's not showing that, oh, originally the price of money is one level and you have a certain amount of money and now it's going to change and you see that change coming. That's not what we're talking. We're just saying hypothetically from day one, what if originally the price of money were one thing, how much would you want to hold? Instead, what if the price of money were something else? How much would you want to hold? Okay, so it's like with when we were doing the price of gasoline and demand curve, we weren't saying, oh, first it's $5 a gallon, and then you buy a certain amount. Now we lower it to four. How many more gallons do you want to buy? Right? We weren't chronologically moving through time and lowering the price and having the person keep possibly buying more gallons, knowing that the price was going to fall further. Right? That's not what was going on. We were just saying a static snapshot in time of counterfactual, you know, possible universes. We were saying, what if in this universe the price of gasoline is $5 a gallon, 100 gallons would you buy? Okay, start over from scratch. What if in this different universe the price of gasoline is $4 a gallon? Okay, so that's what we're doing. So here, this is not showing someone projecting over time the price of money declining and then saying, what's the trajectory of your optimal reactions? Okay? So, okay, and then Dangle says, my question is about how much purchasing power we want to hold, not how much money we want to hold. Well, let me put it this way. Other things equal, as long as you thought the money was going to retain its value, you would want to hold about the same amount of purchasing power, right? The things that, you know, if you want to be able to afford to just on the spur of the moment buy a meal at a restaurant or get 5 gallons of gasoline or catch a cab, all right? Those are the types of things you want to have the ability to instantly buy without using a credit card or without having to go hit the ATM. That's kind of how much cash you're going to hold on to at a given moment. And so for just the level of prices, if you'll forgive me for that terminology, is not going to affect that per se. Now, what is true is that if you're in a regime where the money is constantly losing its purchasing power, then you're going to end up holding less of it, lower cash balances. But that's because you're protecting yourself. You don't want to be holding an asset that's whittling away over time as much. Okay. But I'm saying if you're just talking about a one-time, one fell swoop, everything doubles in price. But once that happens, now you're pretty sure that's it. Now it's going to be stable prices from here on out. You would expect when things settle down in new equilibrium, you would hold twice as much money to have the same purchasing power as you did before. Okay? With all these things, there's real complicated nuances, and we could get real particular. I'm just trying to get you guys to see the big picture as to why demand curves would be downsloping. And then as far as the supply curve, if you just imagine at any given moment in time, that the amount of money is fixed, which is a good first approximation, then the supply curve would just be a straight line. All right, so look at this moment, 10 o'clock, Tuesday afternoon, regardless of what the price of money is, there's just so many dollars in existence right now, then that's the supply curve would be vertical. That's one way of thinking about it, just to get warmed up. And so what happens is prices adjust so that the community collectively wants to hold all the units of money. Because if the price of money is too high, so here's the equilibrium. If the price of money for some reason were too high, well, then there would be a surplus of money. And so that would push the price of money down. And similarly, if the price of money for some reason were too low, then there would be a shortage of money, and that would push the price back up. All right, so I got to move on here because we got a lot of material to cover, but I'm just trying to get you guys to see you can use a standard supply and demand curve framework. It's just the tricky thing is, first of all, the price of money is the opposite of what you're used to, that when the price of money falls, it means prices of goods and services go up and vice versa. And then the other tricky thing is to figure out what does it mean to demand money? And why would somebody demand money? Okay. something I stress in the book is, remember, prices are set by supply and demand. And so it is entirely possible that the quantity of money increases even though its price goes up, meaning prices of goods quoted in money goes down. And so I'll say it again. You know, with apples, the supply curve of apples could shift right, and yet you could have even the equilibrium quantity of apples increase, and yet the price of apples could go up or down depending on what demand does. Okay, so it's the same thing with money, and the reason I included this chart, this is something that some of you may not know this, but I used to work for Arthur Laffer briefly when I first moved to Tennessee, and this is something that I got from him, that he actually had an argument with Milton Friedman. So they had both been advising Ronald Reagan. You know, Reagan sweeps into office, was elected in 1980, and apparently Milton Friedman was looking at the money growth figures and was warning Ronald Reagan in the early 80s, there's going to be really large price inflation. You know, just like we had in the late 70s, it's going to return because the Fed is letting the quantity of money grow too quickly. Whereas Laffer was telling him the opposite and saying, no, Mr. President, what's happening is because of your marginal income tax cuts and because Chairman Volcker slow the rate of monetary growth, and we got price inflation under control, now the rest of the world is going to really want to invest in dollar-denominated assets. So the demand for dollars is going to go way up. So yes, it's true that the quantity of dollars is going to increase, and it did, as you can see from these charts, but Laffer was telling Reagan, don't worry, the demand also is going up, and so we're not going to see a huge takeoff in the growth of price inflation. He probably just said inflation, but I'm saying price inflation so you guys don't get confused. So in terms of supply and demand, it was that Friedman was just looking at the quantity supplied increasing year after year and was alarmed, saying that, the only way we're going to get consumers to be able to keep taking more and more of this stuff is if the price collapses. And so if the purchasing power of money falls, that means dollar prices rise. But Laffer was pointing out, no, these major policy changes you made elsewhere, in particular drastically cutting the top federal marginal income tax rate, now means investors around the world are going to earn a lot more after tax if they hold U.S. assets. And so the demand from investors around the world, you know, they're all going to rebalance their portfolios because now you just sharply cut the marginal tax rate in the U.S. And so investors around the world are going to rebalance their portfolios and want to have a much larger exposure to U.S. assets like stocks and bonds and real estate. And so that's going to cause them in the current foreign exchange markets to go after the dollar. That's going to strengthen the dollar. Okay, and you can see that I don't have it here on this chart, but if you go and look at indices of the U.S. dollar against other currencies, you can see that it is appreciating in the early 1980s. And then they deliberately dropped it in the mid-80s, but that's a separate story. Okay, so specifically from this chart, just in case you were getting confused in the book, you can see there was a fairly tight correlation between the growth in the M1 measure of the stock of money and consumer price index, but then that broke at this period, and you can see that the quantity of money as measured by M1 grew a lot more rapidly than the general consumer price index. And so how can we explain it? Again, it's because the demand for money, for dollars, increased, partially offsetting the larger growth in the quantity of M1. Okay, commodity versus fiat money. Historically, money was not created by the government. So that's a really important thing for you to take away from this. Do not think that you need the government to create money or that historically the state created money. That's not true. Money emerged through voluntary market transactions spontaneously, in the sense that no single individual one day in the state of barter was sitting around and thought, you know, it would be great if we all just started using some intermediate good in our exchanges. Why don't we all start doing that? That's not what happened. So in the earlier sections of the textbook and what we covered, if you've been taking these online courses, we walked through how prices could be, exchange ratios, prices could be formed in a state of barter, and then we talked about the emergence of money. So I'm not going to go through that again, but I just want to reiterate that money is a market phenomenon and that governments came in and muscled their way in and supplanted it. Okay. Traditionally, money in the marketplace was a commodity money, just by its very origin, that before there was money, there were still goods and services, and then one of them or some of them emerged again through this spontaneous process to be the commonly accepted medium of exchange. And so because of that, well, those things would also be commodities. And then for various reasons, because they were durable physically, they were easily divisible, they were homogeneous in the sense that you could cut them in half and it's not like that would fundamentally change its value. The precious metals of gold and silver were just excellent forms of money. And that's what people around the world gravitated towards when they had relative freedom in this area to pick the thing to serve as the monetary unit. And then given that gold and silver, in terms of weights, were the monies, then there were various convenient ways of holding money. So private mints emerged. They would take gold and silver and stamp them into coins that were hard to counterfeit and that they were very aesthetically pleasing. So people could walk around literally with gold coins and silver coins in their pockets. And again, this, you don't need government at all to do this stuff. This isn't just science fiction. George Selgin gave a great talk at the Mises Institute one time, and he's got a whole book on this stuff talking about private mints and how the money produced by private mints was of much better character and quality than the money produced by government mints. And then you could also have banking, where you'd go and deposit your gold coins at a bank and they would give you a receipt, and then the bank would have it on deposit, so you'd go around it and write checks on large sums of money that was being held for you safely at the bank inside the vault. Okay. Over time, governments, as I said, managed to muscle this out, supplant the market's provision of money, until we get to the point where we now have what's called fiat money. So it was a gradual process. It wasn't like on day one, governments around the world just came in and said, okay, instead of using gold and silver coins, from now on, you're using these pieces of paper that we print that aren't backed up by anything. That's not what happened. That wouldn't have worked. All right. What they did was, instead, historically, the government sovereign currencies, like the French franc, the German mark, the U.S. dollar, the British pound, were defined as definite weights of gold or silver. And so that's how people knew what these things were. And then people just got in the habit of quoting prices and thinking in terms of their accounting, in terms of their domestic currency, their sovereign currency, in the system in which they were born. So right now, people born in the United States think in terms of dollars. Even somebody like me, who hates the U.S. monetary system and thinks the dollar is an awful form of money, I still, that's my habit. That's because that's what I've grown up in. It's artificial. It's hard for me to think in terms of kilograms of gold or something, or ounces of gold. All right. But so that's stage one. But still, the way to get people to think like that is to have it, these sovereign currencies redeemable in the precious metals. And that's what is known as the classical gold standard. All right, and again, if you want the details, I talked about it more earlier in the textbook. Now, in the context of our lecture today, what is the harm, or what is the problem in the fact that there was a switch over to fiat money? So eventually, governments around the world, they would temporarily suspend redemption in specie, is what it was called. And so that meant, like, during a war, the government might print up a bunch of pieces of paper of its money in order to pay soldiers or to buy munitions and things like that. And it would realize it couldn't honor the standard redemption pledge of people turning in its paper currency and then getting gold or silver. But it was understood that this was just a temporary interruption because of the wartime emergency, and that eventually, after the war was over and the government stopped printing so much money, things would go back to normal and the government would eventually honor the redemption pledge. But in the 20th century, the public was gradually weaned off of that. So in the United States, in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt seized all the nation's gold and even invalidated gold contracts or clauses and contracts denominated gold, really using the force of the government to get people to stop using this yellow metal. But then in the post-World War II era, there was what was called Bretton Woods, where there still was this weak link, where central banks around the world could turn in dollars for gold, and that somewhat kept the Federal Reserve honest in quotation marks. But then, like I say, by 1971, even that fell. Okay, so from 1971 to the present, the major governments of the world are all operating fiat currencies. They're not backed up by anything. Okay, so what's the problem with that? Well, two ways that money loses value under this system or this principle. So the obvious one is just the loss of purchasing power. So this is pretty straightforward. Other things equal, the government increases the quantity of money, the purchasing power of money is going to drop, and so your money buys less. Now notice, this can be true even in a counterfactual sense, and so it's always true in a counterfactual sense. So even if you have a situation where the government engages in monetary inflation and yet prices don't rise, that doesn't mean that the monetary inflation had no impact on purchasing power. What it means is, oh, if the government hadn't inflated the money, then prices actually would have fallen. Okay, so let me just say that again. Government monetary inflation always reduces the purchasing power of money relative to what it otherwise would have been. We can't say in an absolute sense whether prices are going to go up or down, but we know they're going to go up relative to what they otherwise would have done. And so, and it's funny how much people resist this obvious fact. And I'm going to come back to it in the next slide. I'm going to walk through the mechanics, but keep this in mind. A lot of trained economists can't see what's staring them in the face. They will just say, oh, no. Everyone sees it coming and adjusts, and so it's no big deal. Having the government have a printing press and be able to buy stuff, of course, that gives the government an advantage. It puts everyone else at a disadvantage. But I'll walk through that more in the next slide. The other way money loses its value in the presence of a fiat government monetary regime is that you can't plan. Okay, so what I mean here is, what is the social function of money in the first place? It's that it provides a common denominator for economic transactions. It allows for economic calculation. It allows you to look at a business enterprise, look at how much money was expended on the factors of production, look at how much revenue came in, measured in money, and then see, did we make a monetary profit or loss? That's not the end of the story, but it's the beginning of the story, and it's a crucial part of the story. And so lacking monetary prices, businesses and households are operating in the dark. This is one of the central contributions of Ludwig von Mises to economic thought, was to hammer home just the crucial necessity for genuine money prices. So to the extent that the government is debasing the currency, and in particular debasing it in an unpredictable fashion, people less and less can rely on monetary calculation. You can't make a five-year plan for your business if you don't know what the money's going to buy next year. And it's almost like you're operating in a state of barter. If the money's purchasing power is moving around really in a really volatile fashion. Okay, so those are two separate things. This first point that I'm stressing is just the drop in the purchasing power of money and how that represents a loss of wealth to the people who are holding the money. But the other thing is, to the extent that government makes the purchasing power more unpredictable, it just neuters the very usefulness of having money in the first place. It doesn't totally get rid of it. It's better to have a bad money than to have no money at all. But the point is, and in fact, sometimes governments debase their currency so much that it literally collapses and people use something else. Okay, so to understand what's the big deal, why do people get so worried about monetary inflation? Well, among other dangers, if it gets to be too severe, the people have to abandon that money and go get something else. And so that's very costly, harmful process to go through. If you understand what the social benefits of using money are in the first place, then you can appreciate just how awful and destructive it is if people have to temporarily drop using money and switch to something else as a makeshift. Okay, the Fed is counterfeiter. I don't think I assigned this in your reading. If you want to read more on this, go ahead and look it up. I have a Mises.org article called "The Fed is Giant Counterfeiter." And what I want to stress here is, imagine first that you have a king, and when he runs a deficit, meaning when he spends more than he takes in revenue or your taxes or just people paying him rent for living on his lands or whatever, he just turns, literally has a printing press and just prints up more money and spends it. Nobody should have any problem diagnosing what's going on there and understanding that the king is not really enriching the whole community, but he in fact is engaging in a simple transfer. Because the real resources and goods and services that the king is able to acquire by just printing up more money, he's not creating more real wealth. He's impoverishing everybody else. So specifically, what's going on? How does that happen? He's not literally reaching into someone's store and taking food out. So how can it be that the king, by just printing up money, partially relying on monetary inflation in order to fuel or finance his spending, how is it that he's making other people poor? Well, the way it manifests itself is people will see prices rising in the marketplace even though their own incomes are not rising enough to offset that. Okay? So that's the obvious sense in which the king certainly has the ability, can use the mechanism of monetary inflation in order to raise his own consumption without raising taxes. He can do it. He can get away with it. But don't fool yourself. It's not harmless. He's just doing it in a more subtle way. If he just taxed everybody and then turned around and spent the tax revenue to get food and equipment for his knights and building up his palace, it would be obvious that the king's consumption is coming at the expense of his people. But by the same token, if he's paying for all that stuff not by taxing them but by just running a printing press, clearly his consumption is still coming at the expense of his subjects, but the mechanism is more subtle. What's happening is by him entering the marketplace with newly printed notes, he's driving up prices, making it harder for everybody else to be able to buy those things. So people still see their standard of living drop, and the king sees his standard of living rise, even though there's no taxation involved. Okay, so things are a little bit more subtle nowadays with the way central banks and governments work, but it's the same basic principle. So now what happens is, let's take the United States. The U.S. government, if it's going to run a deficit, it can't just say to the Fed, hey, print up this extra money and we're going to spend it. Right? So if the U.S. government wants to spend $100 billion more than it takes in tax revenue, it can't just print up $100 bills and go buy the stuff with it and then it's done. That's illegal. It can't do that. But what it does do is the U.S. government will issue bonds for $100 billion. So private investors will lend the U.S. government $100 billion, and then the investors will end up selling the bonds to the Fed. And how does the Fed pay them $100 billion? It just creates it out of thin air. So effectively, once you see past the shell game, the Fed is creating money out of thin air in order to acquire U.S. Treasury bonds, thus indirectly creating new money to give to Uncle Sam to cover the deficit. All right, it's not a perfect one-to-one thing, but to the extent that the Fed expands its balance sheet, that helps finance the U.S. government overspending. And then to the extent that the Fed is never going to actually insist that those debts get paid off, that's free money, because even the interest that the Fed earns on its holdings of U.S. Treasuries, after the Fed pays its bills, it remits all of those excess profits back to the Treasury. Okay, so it's like if you're a kid and you borrowed money from your parents and you technically promised to pay them interest, but you knew full well your parents were never going to actually make you pay them back, and even the interest payments you made, they would just turn right around and give it to you as extra money on your birthday. So technically your parents didn't give you the money for free, but in practice they did, if that were the arrangement. All right, and so then once you see that, the consequences are just like the kid who just prints up money to fuel his overspending. And these economists out of the Chicago school who believe in rational expectations of, yeah, consumers can know full well what's going on here, and workers can know full well what's going on here, and they can fully take it into account, but so what? You can't anticipate away the fact that someone over there has a printing press. Clearly, you would be better off if you had the printing press, right? They're almost making it sound like in some of these guys' critiques, and the reason I'm stressing this is because like when Ron Paul was big, a lot of these economists were rolling out, and these weren't paintings, these were free market but Chicago school type guys who believed in rational expectations, and they were like looking at things like, oh, come on, since 1913, yeah, the dollar has fallen in purchasing power, but workers' wages have risen too. And no one was stupid enough to just sit on $100 bills the whole time. They were investing in other assets. They're acting like it was a big wash. Well, if it was a big wash, then how come governments around the world have done this if it doesn't benefit them? That doesn't make any sense. And of course it's not a wash. You would rather you had the printing press than the guy down the street. Okay, the mechanics of government debt, I'm just going to go through this very quickly, partially because it's hard for you probably to see this slide. This comes from the textbook. You just want to, I would encourage you, in case you were going to skip this thinking, oh yeah, I know how government debt works, I would encourage you to actually just go through this because there's probably some subtleties on this part down here to just see how it actually works in practice, just to think through some specific numerical examples. So what I want you to see, and by the way, if you're taking this course for credit, there'll probably be a question or two where you got to fill in missing cells in a table like this. So you definitely want to know how these numbers all fit together. So the idea is the deficit in a given year is just the amount by which expenditures exceed tax receipts. And then the debt, you can see from year to year to year, is based on, it changes based on what the deficit or surplus was that year. Okay, so again, deficit is like an annual mismatch between expenditures and revenues, whereas the debt is like the cumulative history of all the deficits or surpluses. And then you can see in terms of the finance, I'm not going to walk through now because it's hard for me to read this type, it's so small, but also we're running out of time. It's also the case that you can see how interest works, that if the government has to pay interest on its borrowing, what that ends up meaning is they need to use more tax revenue to pay off a debt compared to what they got up front for. So that makes sense to you that, oh yeah, if you borrow $1,000 at 5% interest, the next year you got to pay back $1,050. But another way that that manifests itself is that if the government issues a treasury bill, let's say, that's going to pay $1,000 face value to the holder of it, when they first auction it off, they don't get $1,000 for it, right? The discount is already taken into account up front, and so they will only get paid a smaller amount, whatever, you know, $985, whatever it is, in order, you know, to give somebody a claim that says next year the owner of this piece of paper we will give $1,000 to. So the government doesn't get a full $1,000 up front when it auctions that thing off. So that's another way on short-term IOUs or treasuries that you see the impact of having a positive interest rate on the debt, where the government doesn't get to spend as much now as it will have to spend later to retire that debt. Okay, so does debt burden future generations? Okay, let me just look ahead here for a second. Okay, I just want to make sure I wasn't totally running out of time. Let me spend a good 10 minutes on this one if I can. This is a tricky subject. Okay, so, and incidentally, this is an area where my own thinking has changed. There's a portion in your textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist. It's not that it's totally wrong, but when I wrote that, I wasn't aware of all the nuances. Okay, so that's why I assigned the reading from the Foundation for Economic Education that I did on this topic says government debt kind of burden future generations. You know, that one's the one I'm talking about. So if you read that, you will have the full picture. That's what I'm saying. So if you've been going through this course and you've just been reading the textbook and not doing the supplemental readings, this one in particular for this week, you definitely want to look at that one, okay, because it genuinely adds something that I didn't even realize when I wrote the textbook. So right now, for the next 10 minutes here, let me walk you through what happened, because this is recent. This all happened in 2012. Okay, so originally this guy here, Dean Baker, who was a big Keynesian economist, he's right now, one of his claims to fame is he runs the blog Beat the Press, right, instead of Meet the Press. He's called Beat the Press, B-E-A-T, because he complains about the economic illiteracy in the major media. So you might, that might warm your heart. You might say, oh yeah, I hate the major media too. They're idiots when they talk about economics. But when you read Dean Baker's stuff, he complains that the media doesn't understand the virtues of Keynesian economics. Okay, so that's just, like, he complains about them wringing their hands over austerity. And like, oh geez, our debts are too big. So just keep that in mind. So what happened was, this was, I think it was in late 2011, because I think the major debates were happening in early 2012. Dean Baker came out and he was mad. I think it was this guy, David Brooks. So David Brooks is a big establishment pundit. I don't really know what his formal background is. I don't think he has an advanced degree in anything, but he's a guy who's a columnist. He's on NPR a lot. He's this guy who, I don't know if he's the Washington Post or, you know, a paper like that, but he's on the Sunday talk shows. So he's just a guy who's around a lot and pontificates on U.S. government policy. He's one of those guys. And he had written a column complaining, okay, it's New York Times, thank you, Danny. So David Brooks is New York Times, everybody. So he had written a column complaining about government debt, and he just matter-of-factly said something like, you know, it's a little bit irresponsible when the present generation is running up government debt, because what that really means is we don't have the maturity to just pay for what we want from the government. Instead, we're foisting off the expenditures on our kids and grandkids. And so, hey, you know, the American public needs to just mature. If you want these government services, then you should submit to a tax increase and let the government balance its budget and just pay for them fair and square and be honest about it. And if you don't want to pay for them, if that's too expensive for you, if you don't want to have a tax increase to balance the budget, well then have the government cut spending. But we can't continue this course that we've been going down for decades now, where we want the government to give us all sorts of goodies, but we don't want to pay for them. We just have them run up the deficit or the debt. Because again, that's not fair to our grandkids. We're going to grow up and inherit that debt. Okay, so Dean Baker flipped out and said, this is the stupidest, most idiotic thing, making an Econ 101 mistake, and yet this is a very prevalent mentality. And I'll explain in a minute the problem. And Krugman picked up on it and was saying, oh my gosh, these morons, Dean Baker is totally right. This conventional sort of Tea Party wisdom about government debt as a burden on our grandkids is totally wrong. These people don't understand how macroeconomics and government finance work. These idiots. Okay, now the irony is, besides the name calling, I actually agreed with the narrow point they're going to make, and I'll explain it in a minute here. And then it was these guys down here who convinced me that I was wrong, that I was being too generous and conceding too much to Dean Baker and Paul Krugman. Okay, so this is Don Boudreau of George Mason. And so when he was reading Dean Baker and Krugman going off like this, he pointed to the work of James Buchanan, who back in the day had systematically gone through and argued with the people of his time, like Abba Lerner, who were saying government debt doesn't matter, it doesn't hurt our grandkids. And then this other guy, Nick Rowe, was the guy who finally got me to realize I was being an idiot about this stuff. And this guy's an economist in Canada. And Nick was like using real simple thought experiments, and that made a click for me. Okay. But what Don was saying was perfectly true. I was so locked in the way I was analyzing it, I couldn't get out of that framework. And it took Nick's super simple thought experiment with apples and oranges and two periods to like, oh, geez, I've been – okay. So it's the kind of thing where, I don't know if this has ever happened to you guys, but when you're thinking about something for a certain way for a while, and then you realize you were wrong, you understand it much better. So I was just like a man on a mission. I was like Saul after the road to Damascus conversion. He turns into Paul. And so I wrote a ridiculous amount of stuff on this. And again, if you go to this fee article, I've got a link there, and you can go see all the backstory if you're a super nerd and want to really get into this. But let me tell you now, the very quick version, the news you can use. So here's let me first explain where Dean Baker and Paul Krugman were coming from, because again, I used to, on this one little subtle little point, I thought they had a point, and then it turns out even this is wrong. So what they were saying is, look, government deficits and having the government run a big debt, the only way that's going to make our grandkids poorer is if it crowds out private investment. Okay, so if our grandkids have fewer machines because we consumed more today, then yes, okay, government debts or deficits today make our grandkids poorer. That's true. But they're saying, but that's not what these Tea Party guys have in mind, or that's not only what they have in mind. These Tea Party types and guys like David Brooks, they seem to think they're just looking at the narrow financial aspect of it, and they're saying, oh, our grandkids are going to have to pay more in taxes because the government's going to have a bigger debt to finance 100 years from now if we keep running deficits up today. And so Dean Baker and Krugman are saying that is a fallacy. We're not making our grandkids poorer on net just because the government in 100 years from now is going to have a bigger debt. So whether the government has a debt of $20 trillion or $0 100 years from now is completely irrelevant for that generation taken as a whole. And their argument is, look, it's true if the government today runs up massive deficits and that's how it finances its spending as opposed to just taxing everybody and having a balanced budget. It's true 100 years from now, our grandkids are going to grow up in a world where the government has more debt and has to have higher taxes just to pay the interest on that debt. That's true. They said, but that's not the end of the story. That's not a net loss to our grandkids' generation, because where are those interest payments going? Well, duh, they're going to the people who inherited the treasury balance. Okay, so it's a simple point of accounting, is they're saying, when a government levies taxes to pay interest on the debt, the government debt, it's just a transfer payment. They're taxing one group of people in order then to hand over money to the bondholders. And so Baker and Krugman are saying, so looking at society as a whole, it's a wash. It's just taking money from one group of grandkids and giving it to somebody, another group of our grandkids. We're not impoverishing our grandkids. What the heck? Okay, so I hope you guys see how, oh yeah, that narrow little point, that makes sense. And I even put that in Lessons for the Young Economist. That's why I'm stressing this, because I want to make sure you don't draw the wrong conclusion from that. So that is true, right? Everything I just said is correct, but it's misleading. It makes you think that nowadays we lack the power to put our grandkids in an awkward position and impoverish them just by our debt finance decisions. But there's a subtle point that argument overlooks. And again, I don't have time to get into it now, but if you go and follow the links in that fee article that I provided for you guys, you can see, you can follow the links and go look at what Dean Baker wrote and what Krugman wrote, and then you can see the links to my blog post where I walk through and explain what's wrong. Even though there's a narrow element of, or there's a germ of truth in what I just said, the conclusions that Baker and Krugman drew from that are totally wrong. So, specifically, what can happen is today, the older generation can benefit from government spending. So imagine, like Medicare or Medicaid payments to Social Security recipients. So today's older generation gets to consume more. And instead of paying for it through taxes, what happens is today's working generation, like the people who are 25 to 55, they take some of their savings and instead of doing something in the private sector, they give it to the government. They buy government bonds with it. Okay? So what's happened is the young people today, the working people, have lower consumption in order to acquire government bonds. Now, in 100 years, when the grandkids are not working, and today's workers are now the grandparents, they turn in their government bonds, and the government at that time taxes the young kids, the workers, in order to pay back the bonds plus interest. And so, yeah, it's a simple transfer payment, but it's still, but it's not a wash. It's not that, oh, you're just taking away $1 trillion from one group and giving $1 trillion to another group, so it's a zero-sum game, and except for, you know, the disincentive effect from having a tax, blah, 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 it's just a transfer. No, because it's not a wash. The people getting the interest payments, they had to earlier lower their consumption in order to buy those government bonds. Okay, so that's the element that people or the Krugman and Baker aren't seeing. Okay, so again, let me just say another again. Taking 100 years from now, when the government comes along and taxes the young people, whatever it is, $1 trillion to then pay, make interest payments to the people holding bonds at that point, that hasn't made the bondholders $1 trillion better off just from scratch. No, it's mostly returning their principal from what they lent. Okay, so they're not benefiting by $1 trillion just by getting the bonds paid off. So it's not true that the losses to the new grandkids are perfectly counterbalanced by the gains to the people holding the bonds. Rather, if you want to do the accounting and figure out, well, who is benefiting, it's the people today, the old people today, when the deficits were being run, who get to have higher consumption with no loss, right? It's not like their estates are getting taxed more, right? So they get to get all the Social Security or whatever, the extra goodies of drug benefits from George Bush's Medicare expansion, and their assets aren't being diminished. The way that deficit is being financed is by working people today saving and giving money to the government, lowering their consumption, and then in 100 years, they or their descendants, people they pass the bonds on to, are going to get paid. But again, that's mostly just compensating them for their previous reduction in consumption. Okay, so let me put it to you like this, and this is the way Krugman tried to explain it. Krugman, here's a correct statement. If we just say, if for some reason out of the blue, 100 years from now, the government out of nowhere decided to take $1 trillion from one group of people and give that same $1 trillion to another group of people, that would not make the whole group of people poorer or richer. It would just be a transfer. That's the point Krugman's trying to make. And then from that, he is erroneously concluding, therefore, if the government runs up huge deficits today and then passes along bonds to people 100 years from now, and then at that time taxes one group of people in order to make a payment to the bondholders, well, it's just a wash. And what I'm trying to tell you is, no, it's not. Because at that moment, when you tax the one people and hand it over to the others, you're hurting the taxpayers by $1 trillion, but you're not making the recipients $1 trillion richer on net, because they're already weighed down because they had lower consumption earlier in their lifetime. Okay, so I tried to hit that point. I could spend a whole class going through the nuances of that. So I'm hoping you at least clicked and saw what the fallacy was. So if you want me to put it specifically, what's going on, what Dean Baker and Krugman were overlooking was the fact that there can be overlapping generations. Okay, instead, they were imagining all the people today do their thing and then die and then just hand over bonds to people, to our grandkids, who get them for free. And then everything starts over. And so they thought it was equivalent, that interest payments on the debt are just as if the government out of the blue randomly starts taxing some group of people to give free money to other groups of people, and then that, hey, that's just a wash. But in practice, that's not what happened. The bondholders earlier in their lives gave up something to get those bonds. Either they were the original buyers of bonds, or more likely in practice, especially the longer in the future we go, they had to pay money to acquire the bonds from somebody else. Right? So if somebody today lends money to the government to get some bonds, waits 20 years, and then sells them to somebody else, well then, you know, that process rolls over. So maybe the exact holders of the bonds 100 years from now are not the people who were alive today to finance the senior citizens' consumption binge, but still, the people 100 years from now who are getting paid off on their bond, they had to give up money earlier to get those bonds, or their parents gave it to them and the parents had to give up money to get them. Okay, so the point is, those bonds were not acquired for free, and that's what you would need in order for Krugman and Baker's argument to, it's just a wash to go through. Okay. And incidentally, after I figured all that stuff out and realized that, wow, this guy Buchanan was really sharp, he's a Nobel Prize winner for his foundation for, he laid the foundation for what we now call public choice, and that I appreciated what Boudreau had been saying all along. So in other words, once it clicked for me, I went back and reread some of Boudreau's stuff and was like, yeah, he was totally right. I don't know why I missed that. And the stuff that this guy Nick Rowe was saying, you know, made more and more sense. And then I, like I said, I got into it and I would like to think clarified it for a lot of people, like a lot of outside economists who realized there was a war going on, and that once I got my footing, I was trying to clarify for everybody to explain, okay, what he's saying is this, but what he's saying is this. What was funny is I went and found in Human Action, Mises has a few offhand remarks when he's talking about Abel Lerner, and he just blows this whole thing up too. So it's not that Mises was thinking in terms of an overlapping generation model of apple trees the way this guy Nick Rowe was, but the point is Mises, everything he said was perfectly correct, and he saw the fallacy. I forgot to tell you guys, the central fallacy involved here is government debt is not a burden to society because we owe it to ourselves. All right, so I'm putting that in quotation marks. That's the fallacy. So I'll put it in. All right, that's wrong. It's a fallacy. And that's what this guy, Abel Lerner, was saying back in the day when Mises grappled with him. And it's what effectively Baker and Krugman were saying. They were saying, look, it's their point was Krugman and Baker and then this guy, Abel Lerner, back in the day, they were trying to say, don't think of it in terms of an individual household, that there's a mistake of composition, a fallacy of composition. Yeah, an individual household, if you run up a debt that lowers your standard of living down the road in the future, you've got to pay it off. But they were saying, society as a whole, don't think like that. As long as Americans, for example, are the ones who own the bonds issued by the U.S. government, well, we're not making America poor. We're just making transfer payments. And again, that is wrong. Thinking like that is wrong. And Buchanan pointed it out, and then Boudreau and this guy Nick Rowe were pointing it out. And they were just going nuts. And guys, we settled this in the 60s. Come on. This is just the same mistake over and over. And Baker and Krugman are just not only wrong, but they're ignorant of the history of economic thought. Okay, I don't see any pending questions. If you guys want to ask something, go ahead. But if not, I have one more slide I can touch on in the remaining 5 minutes here. Okay, the relation between inflation and government debt. So the reason I have a picture of Rothbard here is he really, for me personally, just thinking through this stuff, he crystallized it for me. It was in his collection called Making Economic Sense that the Mises Institute has. So that's a great collection of essays that are mostly economic, whereas there's some other collections they have where Rothbard's more like talking about culture and things like that. But Making Economic Sense, as the title suggests, is a collection of shorter pieces that aren't too technical, where Rothbard's like talking to the common man, but explaining things like free trade and and so on, minimum wage laws and what have you. But anyway, this issue of inflation and government debt, it's a tricky one, and it's very subtle. So on the one hand, government debt per se is not inflationary. But that word per se is important, that phrase per se is important. So what I mean is the mere act of the government borrowing money, the mere act of the government running a budget deficit, spending more in a given year or time period than it takes in tax receipts, that by itself is not inflationary. The government is not creating more money in the economy just by spending more than it takes in revenues. And I'm stressing that because a lot of times people talk as if that is true. You know, they'll just say matter of fact, oh yeah, when the government keeps running these deficits, that's going to weaken the dollar and we're going to see prices rise. So again, strictly speaking, that's not true. You could have, for example, a government on a perfect 100% backed commodity standard where like every dollar bill was backed by a certain amount of gold in a vault in Fort Knox. And the government could still run budget deficits during certain years. The laws of accounting wouldn't prevent it from doing that. And yet the dollar would still be perfectly backed up by gold in the vaults. Okay, so there's no necessary connection. However, in practice, it is true. So in practice, government will lean on the central bank to inflate, to ease the burden of its debts. Okay, so in practice what happens is, first of all, the mechanism we talked about earlier, where just to finance the deficit year to year, the central bank will purchase government security, bring it on its balance sheet. In the very act of doing that, the central bank creates new money. All right, so let's talk about the Federal Reserve. That's the one I know the most. The Federal Reserve, if it wants to buy $100 billion worth of treasuries, how does it do that? Well, it effectively writes a check to a bond dealer for $100 billion. The bond dealer gives the $100 billion worth of treasuries to the Fed. The Fed is now the owner. It's on its asset side of its balance sheet. And the check that the Fed gave to the bond dealer for $100 billion, the bond dealer deposits that in a commercial bank. And so now that commercial bank's reserves with the Fed, whoop, just went up by $100 billion. So where'd that money come from? Didn't come from anywhere. The Fed just changes the computer entry. Instead of that bank having a balance of $80 billion, now it has a balance of $180 billion. Okay? So it's inflationary, monetary inflation, when the central bank buys that. And so now, to the extent that you're suspicious and you think that if the government is running massive deficits, that they're going to lean on the central bank and say, hey, wouldn't it be nice if you would increase your purchase of these assets? And why would they do that? Well, because a bond, its price moves inversely to its yield. So if the price of a bond goes up, the yield on it goes down. So if you're talking about government debt, if more people are trying to buy government bonds, treasuries, if you're talking about the U.S., other things equal, their price, their market price goes up, more people are trying to buy them, that means their yield goes down. So that means U.S. interest rates, specifically interest rates on government bonds, goes down. So if the government's running massive deficits, they don't want interest rates to spike. That'll spook people. That'll make people think the government's being irresponsible. And in fact, the chief trump card of the Keynesians in the last few years, the way they've been excusing away the massive deficits that governments around the world have been running, is to say, what? Interest rates are fine. What are you guys talking about? you Austrians and you Austerians were warning us that interest rates were going to zoom up by running these trillion-dollar-plus deficits. No, they haven't. All right, well, at the same time, central banks around the world have been, in an unprecedented fashion, expanding their balance sheets and gobbling up these bonds. Okay, so again, other things equal, the central bank, if it buys more bonds, pushes up the price of the bonds, which pushes down the interest rate. Okay, so that is inflationary, because the central bank gets the bond by creating more money. So, in summary, when you're wondering about does government debt, or deficits is the more accurate thing, do government deficits cause inflation or put pressure on prices to make them rise? Not directly. So strictly speaking, no, the government running a deficit does not per se create new money and does not create a pressure for prices quoted in money to go up. However, in practice, there's a very cozy relationship between the central government and the central bank. Of course, the central bank can only exist and get away with what it does because of the privileges granted to it by the government. And part of what the quid pro quo is, in my opinion and the opinion of many other cynics, is that the central bank does not have an independent monetary policy. The central bank does not just, the managers of the central bank do not just sit around in a corner drawing curves on a chalkboard and pontificating and coming up with what their disinterested scientific theories tell them to do. No, they know if the government is having fiscal trouble and they expand their purchases. And you can see this most clearly, I realize I'm over time, this last thing I'll say to you guys, it's most obvious that's why there's price inflation during wars. Go look at what the central banks do. They massively increase their purchase of government securities when there are major wars. So why do they do that? Is that just a coincidence? Oh, for some reason, central bankers like to engage in massive rounds of QE when there's bombs blowing up? No. It's because the government knows it can't finance the war through taxes and even just normal borrowing, that private investors are not going to voluntarily hand over the savings required for the government to meet all of its war needs. And so it turns to the printing press. Okay, I will stop there. I'll get your quiz posted soon. I'll announce when the office hours will be this week. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And next week, we have our final lecture.